You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in studio by producer Alex. Coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the FBI opening up an office in Wellington and multiple countries announcing their plans to formally recognise Palestinian statehood and whether we plan to here in Aotearoa. I also spoke to Professor George Laking from Te Aka Matauranga Mate Pukupu Centre for Cancer Research at the University of Auckland about new research showing hospitalisations of cardiovascular diseases increasing following tropical cyclones. Alex, what's here for us today?
I spoke to the co-director of the Geothermal Institute at the University of Auckland, Dr. John O'Sullivan, about the government's recent draft strategy for geothermal energy and what geothermal energy means for Aotearoa. I also spoke to Workers First union organiser Jess Geary about Foodstuffs North Island's promise that the workers displaced by the Victoria Park New World fire would be rehired at the New Point Chevalier store, which has not fully come to fruition.
He aho whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku patuhi mai, text it on 5395, or wire mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e wareware e a hei ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō, hei pakihiri rokiroki mā runga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakatikam. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Last week, it was announced that the FBI would open a dedicated attaché office in Wellington to investigate threats such as terrorism, child exploitation and cybercrime. Announcing the office, Director of the FBI, Kash Patel, says the event is a historic moment and that with this move, it symbolises the FBI's prioritisation of having a permanent presence across all Five Eyes countries, which New Zealand is a part of. Police Minister Mark Mitchell says Patel's visit to the country sends a clear message to criminals that they cannot hide behind any international border. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court, I spoke to Simon about the FBI's office and some criticisms the move has had. We also spoke about multiple countries recently indicating their moves to formally recognise a state of Palestine and what plans Aotearoa has in this space. But first, we discuss the FBI's new office in the capital. The FBI have had personnel stationed here for several years, but why are we now seeing this dedicated office?
Well, that's right. The US is a long and strong friend of New Zealand, and we have had a lot of cooperation on transnational crime over the years, which is a major problem for New Zealand, even though it might be below the radar of most Kiwis as they go about their day. Well, having an FBI office doesn't really change that, but it does strengthen that relationship, and it allows us to be a lot more efficient when prosecuting crime that occurs across borders. Until now, the main FBI liaison office has actually been in Australia, although they have had staff and an office here. So it just means that we're going to have access to the same level of intelligence and cooperation and support as the Australians do when combating transnational crime and terrorism.
Director Kash Patel, in announcing the office, said a target of the office would be to counter Chinese influence in the Pacific. The Chinese embassy has come out saying these comments are a part of a Cold War mentality. Will comments like these, and maybe even an office like this, have an impact on Aotearoa's relationship with China?
Well, New Zealand has a very strong relationship with China. They're our main trading partner. But I think it's also important to note that many commentators would say that there is a Cold War going on, that China is seeking to influence and even control some areas, you know, in the Pacific, Asia, you know, either militarily, by occupying islands in the South China Sea, by basically been very aggressive in their relationships with countries that are our allies, like the Philippines, like Taiwan. So it's important that, you know, we have as much cooperation and, you know, strengthen our relationship with our Five Eyes Alliance partners, which includes the United States, Australia, Canada, and the UK. It's got to be a good thing that we are united in saying what's important. You know, we believe that we should defend liberty. Small democracies and larger ones like the US need to stick together. Otherwise, countries, you know, like the Communist Party of China, run China, will seek to influence and control our neighbours and make it much tougher for us.
There was a protest set up here in Auckland over the weekend in light of this announcement outside the US consulate. Protects Putiki, one of the groups involved in the protest, say that the FBI has no place in Aotearoa and that their presence undermines New Zealand's sovereignty, independent foreign policy and our democracy. How would you respond to this, and what are your reactions to this protest?
Well, they're wrong and they're silly. Because the reason the New Zealand police have a strong relationship with the FBI, and why, you know, a foreign police force like the FBI is here to help catch those engaged in illegal harmful activities like drug smuggling, online child exploitation, and, you know, making sure that we can disrupt and prevent acts of terrorism both here in New Zealand and in our neighbourhood. So they're wrong. And they're silly.
And you mentioned the Five Eyes Alliance before, but what does a move like this represent for New Zealand's involvement as a member of the Five Eyes?
Well, what it means is that New Zealanders can see that we are, as a government, absolutely focused on our relationships with our overseas partners. Our intelligence agencies, like the NZSAS and the GCSB, who are responsible for monitoring and filtering communications and identifying threats, that they have the support of the FBI, which, you know, must be the largest and most important intelligence agency that's established here. So, look, you know, Kiwis should feel comfortable and confident that New Zealand is part of an alliance that is keeping them safe and contributing to international security in our region.
Moving on to our next topic, we have also seen countries such as France, the UK and Canada announce their plans to formally recognise Palestinian statehood. Currently, 147 of the 193 UN member countries recognise a Palestinian state. However, New Zealand is not one of them. Why is Aotearoa not one of these countries?
Well, New Zealand is part of a group of countries that have said that they're should be a two-state solution for Israel and the Palestinians, but we do have to be careful that we're not seen to be rewarding Hamas for a disgusting terror attack on 7th of October 2023. And what New Zealand has said is that Hamas should release the hostages first and lay down their weapons before a two-state solution can be progressed. Our Foreign Minister Winston Peters confirmed this when I asked him a question in Parliament last week, that recognising a state of Palestine now would send the wrong message.
Would the ACT Party be in support of recognising Palestinian statehood? You kind of touched on this before, but is this something that you guys would be open to discussion with this government in doing?
Well, ACT is part of the coalition government. Will respect decisions that are taken around Palestinian statehood. But I want to make it clear that declaring or recognising a state of Palestine now risks rewarding terrorism, and that what we would want to see is that Hamas lay down their weapons, release the hostages, and that the Palestinian Authority or whatever entity is left in charge of that area agrees to operate as a demilitarised state that is not capable of being a threat to Israel. That would have to be a bottom line.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court on the FBI's new office in Wellington and multiple countries moving to recognise a Palestinian state and what New Zealand's plans are in this regard.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Last week, Minister for Resources and Regional Development Shane Jones announced from the ground up a draft strategy to unlock New Zealand's geothermal potential. This draft strategy highlights a shift in focus towards the geothermal market, identifying it as one with potential for growth and innovation as a cornerstone of New Zealand's energy environment. I spoke to the co-director of the Geothermal Institute within the Faculty of Engineering at the University of Auckland, Dr. John O'Sullivan, about geothermal energy and what this focus could mean. You obviously think highly of geothermal energy. Why is this an energy that we should be focusing on?
Look, geothermal energy is one of the most cost-effective forms of renewable energy. It is a renewable energy. It's very low carbon, and also, you know, we're working on technologies to make it completely net zero or even net negative carbon. It is a little tricky because the investment comes up front, but then the operating costs of geothermal energy are very, very low. So it's attractive from a economic point of view. It's attractive from an environmental point of view. And the other really important point is that it's baseload energy, so it's always on. It doesn't matter if the sun's shining or the wind's blowing or the dams are full, geothermal's going to run. So it's really good from an energy security perspective. And also, we're really lucky in New Zealand that the geothermal energy is mostly in the centre of the North Island, but there are other parts of New Zealand that have access to geothermal energy. But you know, having that out in the regions is really important for supporting regional development and regional growth. So all round, it's a pretty exciting field to work in. Plus, we've been doing this for a very long time, and we're world leaders at it. So it's something that New Zealand's got a real long-term expertise in.
You hinted on it a little bit in there, but considering geothermal in the wider landscape of renewable energy in New Zealand, why is geothermal specifically, like you mentioned the dams being full, but to maybe somebody who wanted to push for nuclear or a heightened investment in wind, what gives geothermal that bonus, that push?
Look, I think, you know, to meet our energy needs and at the same time our commitment to reducing our CO2 and or greenhouse gases, we're going to need to use all the technology we can. So I think wind is going to play a really important part of it. But it's that baseload power. So, yeah, when the wind's not blowing, having baseload power that you know you're going to get. So geothermal offers that. And I hinted at it as well, talking about our expertise. Look, you know, aside from all the politics around nuclear energy, the fact that we're proudly nuclear free, it's the expertise. Nuclear is really expensive, and the expertise would have to come from basically America or maybe Europe. But whereas geothermal, we're world leaders in. So it's a lot cheaper to invest in geothermal to get that baseload. Nuclear can be baseload as well, but so. So, you know, we'd be giving up energy security essentially by going down the nuclear path, whereas geothermal would be investing heavily in energy security. So it really, it'd be part of a portfolio of energy, renewable energy, and it would complement wind and solar and hydro. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a really great option for New Zealand.
So what does the government's strategy actually entail, and how do you especially want to see that kind of play out?
So at this stage, it's a draft strategy, so it's out for consultation until, I think, in December is when submissions are due, or maybe end of November. And so what it really shows is it's this long-awaited signal from the government that geothermal's going to be really important going forward. I mean, it's been important to New Zealand for the last 50 years, and it's kind of this quiet achiever. I mean, when we were down in Taupo last week for the announcement of the new draft strategy, geothermal on one of the days was providing 22% of our electricity, and most people just aren't even aware of that it's such an important part of our energy mix. And so the strategy not only gives us a chance to sort of work with the government and make it clear where we're headed with geothermal, but it also acknowledges how important New Zealand it is for New Zealand and has been in the past. So hopefully we can get young people excited about the prospect of a future of working in geothermal and get the right people in to sort of, you know, power that growth that we're going to need going forward, and geothermal is going to be a big part of. And it's not just the growth and energy production, but also, you know, making sure we do it in a way that protects, you know, the parts of geothermal that are used for tourism and for cultural, you know, taonga and what have you. So, you know, it's across the board. The strategy is across the board for how we think about and look after the geothermal resource for, you know, powering the future.
I mean, you've pretty much covered it all there, but is there anything else that you think that New Zealanders or people listening should know about geothermal and maybe get behind this?
Yeah, I mean, it is, this, like I said, it's something that we're really good at. We've got this proud history of using it for energy. You know, the Māori have been using it for 100, you know, 600, 700, 800 years for cultural uses and cooking and all kinds of things. So we've got this long connection with geothermal, and it can really play an important part in the future for energy and, as I said, for everything else as well, and around tourism and cultural uses and things. So there's something in it for everyone. It is a point of difference with the supercritical geothermal technology. Potentially, you know, we're going to be going deeper and getting more energy. That's something, again, we can be world leaders at, and technology we can essentially export. So there's really exciting technical challenges around that. It's a great career in geothermal, solving problems, doing it with local communities, doing it, you know, to support a secure renewable energy transition. And with the potential to, you know, also travel and visit interesting parts of the world that are also interested in trying to meet these challenges. So, yeah, come see us at the Geothermal Institute and talk about a career in the future.
That was the Geothermal Institute's Dr. John O'Sullivan on the government's draft geothermal strategy.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Do you, Samantha, take Coco's Cantina's Tuesday Mates Rate deal, pairing $6 Prosecco or Peroni with $17 pizzas as your deliciously wedded weekday partner?
I do!
And do you also take the late night $9 happy hour, 9 till 10 on Fridays and Saturdays, as your weekend lover?
Oh my God, yes! A partner and a weekend lover? Oh, does this count as ethical non-monogamy?
And feel the love at Coco's Cantina, Tuesday to Saturday, 374 Karangahape Road.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Hey, what are you doing here?
Just, I've been given 24 hours to write a funny ad for a Bic Runga giveaway.
You're making fun of Bic Runga.
Who's making fun of Bic Runga?
No, it's just an ad. I was just...
This is absolutely unbelievable.
How could you do this? My life.
One of Aotearoa's most beloved songwriters, the wonderful Bec Runga, is playing songs from her Divine Back catalogue, live with the Auckland Philharmonia, Saturday, September 6th at the Kiri Te Kanoa Theatre. Listen to 95BFM Breakfast all this week to win tickets, or get yours now from Ticketmaster.
Future sounds from the underground. The hottest new tracks from Aotearoa and around the world.
Totally Wired.
Sounds from up to 2 weeks in the future. Next month, even.
Some of these tracks are like 2026 vibes, bruv.
A great amount of energy.
Totally Wired with Hunter. Tomorrow's music today, 11 a.m. till 2 p.m. Only on 95BFM. Thanks to Flying Out. flyingout.co.nz.
I can claim the dreamer from the dream. Make you feel everything you've never even seen. It's been a long, a long, a long, a long, a long, long
BFM.
This song is In the Mouth, a Desert by Pavement. Before that, you had Favourite by Fontaines DC. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
And eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
Recent findings from six countries, including New Zealand, of over 6.5 million cardiovascular disease hospitalizations show a correlation between hospitalizations and the aftermath following a tropical cyclone. The research looked into the hospitalizations of six different cardiovascular diseases and showed that hospitalizations increased 2 months following a tropical cyclone and continued for 6 months after. I spoke to Professor George Laking from Te Aka Matauranga Mate Pukupu Centre for Cancer Research at the University of Auckland about the study and a similar study he helped conduct following Cyclone Gabriel, Te Wiu Me Te Wai. Here is that interview. Regarding these findings, how serious are these findings?
This is a large international study that's looked at data from big populations over several years. And so that means it's quite persuasive in terms of the inferences it can make about what happens with cardiovascular events following cyclones.
This is quite a unique space to be researching. What is the inspiration behind the study?
It's been widely recognised within the medical community for going on two decades that climate change is the number one threat to human health in the 21st century. However, it has really been an uphill battle to get that message across to our governments and policymakers, and we see that playing out with the denial of the climate crisis that happens around the Western world, and that's really down to the influence of the oil industry.
And how would you recommend that politicians and governments and policymakers go about addressing these concerns when developing cyclone responses?
Well, if they have an interest in the well-being of the people, which I have to say, looking at decisions taken by many of our governments recently, seems to be at least questionable, but if they do have an interest in the well-being of the people, then they will do everything in their power to try to decarbonise economies and change the lifestyles of people to adapt and adjust to what is already going to happen with climate change. And so that means we need to have more healthy lifestyles in general, more physical activity and more plant-based diets.
Linking back to the study itself, what are we seeing specifically here in Aotearoa?
Well, that was interesting because I was involved in some work in that area myself, and that was in the east coast of the North Island following Cyclone Gabrielle. We weren't able to pick up such a signal there. However, the population we're working with was substantially smaller than what's in this study, I think a couple of orders of magnitude, and the time interval also that we had to work with was shorter than in this study. In general, for this study, the findings from New Zealand fit in to the findings from the rest of the world, but just because our population is smaller, there's always a bit more statistical uncertainty in that type of study for New Zealand. Interestingly, there did seem to be a signal coming through at the north end of the South Island for increased cardiovascular events after cyclones. The connection really is not too hard to figure out what it would be. Simply the stress and disruption brought about by cyclone events isn't good for people's circulatory health in the longer term.
As you mentioned, your research looked at, followed on from Cyclone Gabrielle in 2023 and looked at the populations of Tairawhiti and the Hawke's Bay. Would there be a difference in how different parts of the country react? Are these findings similar across the country?
So there are differences in the experiences, and that kind of relates to differences in the landscape and the way events play out depending where you are. For example, in Hawke's Bay, their catastrophe was more based on a very large flooding event, a small amount of very large flooding event, whereas in the East Coast, they had multiple flooding events, but maybe not quite as big as the Esk Valley event. So that's a response of geography. That's a feature of geography. But ultimately, the amount of stress and disruption that these put on to people all comes out in the realm of health, ultimately.
With the climate crisis creating stronger and more frequent cyclones and weather events as a whole, do you expect that the number of cardiovascular hospitalisations will increase?
Well, that depends if there's still going to be hospitals, isn't it? And that seems to be seriously in question with the way the current government's going. But yeah, if there's hospitals to take them, there'll be more pressure on the hospitals. Because of these types of events, yes.
And we've been discussing cardiovascular hospitalizations, which is what your study and this study we're talking about addresses, but how do cyclones and weather events impact other parts of an individual's health, such as their mental health, for example?
Yeah, mental health is really big. And more than anything, I think mental health is what came out in our work. And the thing is, people think that the weather event is over, but it casts a long shadow in the area of mental health. And for example, every time it rains for quite a while after a cyclone, and flooding. A lot of people find that very stressful, and you know, they use the term rain anxiety about that. But then there's other types of health effects that you could expect. It's certainly contamination, pollution of water supply, of soils, respiratory effects from dusts in the air. So I think the thing about human health is it picks up pretty much everything that's going on, and it gives you an indicator of how well you're doing with your society and with your environment. And we're not doing very well at the present, so we've got to expect that human health is going to suffer from that.
And this study and your previous study, yet again, looks at tropical cyclones, but do you expect we would see similar results for other climate-related natural disasters, such as with droughts and wildfires?
Well, in the sense that they're adverse for health, that's absolutely sure. Yeah, I've got to say, there is one angle which is quite interesting, which is the New Zealand events featured very heavy rainfall, but not so much in the realm of destructive high winds, at least in the East Coast where we were. And I did wonder about it with some of those events at more equatorial zones where they had destructive high winds, and those can be much more immediately lethal compared to if you just get the flooding, but not to underestimate the health harm of any cyclone events and the health harm of flooding, that's for sure.
And we've briefly touched on this previously, but what needs to change to mitigate these correlations between cardiovascular hospitalizations and mental health outcomes following tropical cyclones and just weather events as a whole?
Well, you know, we could all be living much more healthy lives, and that relates to diet, physical activity, how we connect to each other as people, how our communities work. That was really the big finding of our study on the East Coast, which was called Te Wera Me Te Wai, the health effects of adverse weather, was how well people got through the cyclone really depended on how well they were connected as communities going into the cyclone. And I think there's a pretty strong expectation that how well you get through these things is a big factor in what happens with health in the longer term. I think there's a issue with our political systems at the moment which have failed to take us on a path that's going to decarbonise our economies in a meaningful way. They've absolutely failed that over the last 20, 30 plus years. And a lot of that has got to do with the untoward influence on our political system of powerful businesses, and especially the fossil fuel industry. They're to blame, really.
That was Te Akama Tauranga Ma Te Pukupu Centre for Cancer Researchers, Professor George Laking, on a recent study showing an increase of cardiovascular disease hospitalizations 6 months on from a tropical cyclone.
The Wire.
We'll be right back.
Just relax. From this my position, I make some stand. I make my peace with the man. And it goes pow, 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 pow. Pow, 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 pow. It goes pow, 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 pow. Pow, 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 pow. From this position, I can see both of them. From this position, I totally get how the decision was reached. From this position, I can say serious or cop out or hard to define. From this position, it's I'm eating myself to death.
You are the
From this position, I have a good grip on both of them. Because I have stayed home and have learned a little more about my neighborhood, which is important. You know, it's one of the good places to meet. And so it's pow, 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 pow. Pow, 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 pow. So it's pow, 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 pow.
And then home and away again to ease up your desire.
Welcome back. You're tuned in to The Wire on 95BFM.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
Following the fire at the Victoria Park New World, Foodstuffs North Island promised to hire displaced workers at the soon-to-open Port New World Point Chevalier. However, with the opening of the Point Chevalier store on 19th of August, a significant number of displaced employees remain out of work, with 40% without job offers as their paychecks come to an end. I spoke to Workers First union organiser Jess Geary about Foodstuff's promise, the current rehiring situation, and what the union would like to see in the near future from Foodstuffs. First Union says that Foodstuffs North Island promised to rehire employees from the Victoria Park New World. What exactly did this promise entail?
So basically, when we had meetings with the company, with the new Victoria Park management team, they told us that there's going to be 80 jobs will be upcoming at Newwood Point Shift. And they were going to bring the opening of the store a little bit forward. So now they're opening the store on the 19th of August. And they told the staff and employees and us as well that there's going to be 100 more jobs will be across the other stores in Auckland. But what happened since then is that only 42 workers or 42, 45 workers have been only redeployed into the Point Shift store. And the rest of the workforce is still looking for jobs somewhere else. Now, they have come back and said to us that they have employed around 60% of the workforce which were displaced by the fire, but we're still waiting for the 40% of the rest of the workforce to be redeployed or to find any other opportunities across these stores, and they'll be out of pocket from today.
So you kind of hinted at it there, but what steps, if any, have Foodstuffs actually taken?
So what they have done is that they initially organized a meeting with the union and also with the workforce on the 9th of June, and where they basically announced, you know, what I've just told you, that how many jobs is going to be available and people can apply for it. They have brought HR from different organizations. So initially there was no plan. We reached out to Newark Victoria Park management team and we did a submission to them saying that please do bring different HRs from different stores. And what we can do is we can do an expo where there will be enough opportunities and guidance for these staff members who are waiting to apply for other jobs, and you can help them out. So they have organized that. And in all fairness, it was looking pretty promising on the day, on the 10th as well, which was the next day of the after the meeting. And so all these employees, they went and they put their expression of interest and made availability and improved the CVs and did all the paperwork which they're supposed to do. But since then, they've just been waiting to hear back from the company, and they haven't heard. Some of the employees, they haven't even heard if they have got a job or not, and they're just sitting in the dark, hoping for the best.
So what kind of conditions are these? Because you've mentioned that these employees are facing financial uncertainty, but could you expand on the kind of conditions that these employees are facing?
Yeah, so we've been talking to a lot of union members and the other staff as well. There's a lot of them, they have to pay their mortgages. There's one couple who were working at Newwood Victoria Park. Both husband and wife, they were working in there. They both are out of employment because they haven't been redeployed yet. So there's no source of income for them. There's a lot of other workers as well. They live paycheck to paycheck, and they don't know what to do from now onwards, and they don't know how they're going to pay their mortgages or even going to be able to afford the groceries.
If Foodstuffs do not fulfill this promise, how do you at the union see the situation developing?
I think so. It's going to be very, very disappointing because these workers, they've been working there for many, many years, and they've been a very loyal employees to the organization and also as part of the Foodstuff community as well. So I think so. One of the things which the Foodstuff management team have come back and said that they're going to be looking after these employees, and they're really going to work through this whole issue, and they're going to work with the staff members as well. And if that doesn't happen, I think that this is going to be very disappointing. And also, these people, like, 40% of them, they won't have any money to live on, and they'll be out of pocket, right? So that's the worst thing for them. And they're also, the market is tough, and also there's a cost of living crisis. So it will be very, very disappointing to hear that, if that takes place. Yeah.
Are you concerned that this behaviour from Foodstuffs might set a sort of precedent for similar situations?
I comment on that because there will be, another situation somewhere else, and there might be some other details into it. But what I can say is that these workers do need to find some job. They need to be redeployed into other sectors, and these jobs, we're told that there's going to be 180 jobs, and there was 189 staff members who were going to be applying for these jobs. So, and I think that that's something which we really were concerned about, and we're still concerned about, that all these workforce hasn't been deployed into these roles which was supposed to be offered to them.
And what are the union's next steps, and what do you hope to see come from this?
So what we really hope is that they fulfill their promise and they do the right thing. These workforce, again, these employees, they've been very loyal employees to the organization. They've been working there for a couple of decades, if not more. And they're really looking forward to work within the food staff as a community, as a company. So they're really, really hoping that they find a job and they won't be out of pocket.
Is there anything else that you want to add to this?
I just want to request the company to work with all the workforce, the 40% of the workforce who hasn't been redeployed into any of the roles. They need to get in touch with those workers and really work with them to make sure that they have been redeployed into the other sectors or the other stores and really help them in this tough time and the stressful time of their lives.
That was Workers First Union's Jess Geary on Foodstuffs North Island's unfulfilled promise to rehire displaced workers after the Victoria Park New World fire.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hō taka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Simon Court, the co-director at the Geothermal Institute at the University of Auckland, Dr. John O'Sullivan, Te Aka Matauranga Mate Pukupu Centre for Cancer Researchers at George Laking, and Workers' First Union organiser, Jess Giddy. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.